Chapter 23. Containing the whole science of government, the Circumlocution Office was, as everybody knows without being told, the most important department under government. No public business of any kind could possibly be done at any time without the acquiescence of the Circumlocution Office. Its finger was in the largest public pie, and in the smallest public tart. It was equally impossible to do the plainest right, and to undo the plainest wrong without the express authority of the Circumlocution Office. If another gunpowder plot had been discovered half an hour before the lighting of the match, nobody would have been justified in saving the Parliament until there had been half a score of boards, half a bushel of minutes, several sacks of official memoranda, and a family vault full of ungrammatical correspondence on the part of the Circumlocution Office. This glorious establishment had been early in the field, when the one sublime principle involving the difficult art of governing a country was first distinctly revealed to statesmen. It had been foremost to study that bright revelation, and to carry its shining influence through the whole of the official proceedings. Whatever was required to be done, the Circumlocution Office was beforehand with all the public departments in the art of perceiving how not to do it. Through this delicate perception, through the tact with which it invariably seized it, and through the genius with which it always acted on it, the Circumlocution Office had risen to overtop all the public departments, and the public condition had risen to be what it was. It is true that how not to do it was the great study and object of all public departments and professional politicians all around the Circumlocution Office. It is true that every new premier and every new government, coming in because they had upheld a certain thing as necessary to be done, were no sooner come in than they applied their utmost faculties to discovering how not to do it. It is true that from the moment when a general election was over, every returned man who had been raving on hustings because it hadn't been done, and who had been asking the friends of the honorable gentleman in the opposite interest on pain of impeachment to tell him why it hadn't been done, and who had been asserting that it must be done, and who had been pledging himself that it should be done, began to devise how it was not to be done. It is true that the debates of both houses of Parliament the whole session through uniformly tended to the protracted deliberation how not to do it. It is true that the royal speech at the opening of such session virtually said, "My lords and gentlemen, you have a considerable stroke of work to do, and you will please to retire to your respective chambers and discuss how not to do it." It is true that the royal speech, at the close of such session, virtually said, "My lords and gentlemen, you have through several laborious months been considering with great loyalty and patriotism how not to do it, and you have found out, and with the blessing of Providence upon the harvest, natural, not political, I now dismiss you." All this is true, but the Circumlocution Office went beyond it. Because the Circumlocution Office went on mechanically, every day, keeping this wonderful, all-sufficient wheel of statesmanship, how not to do it, in motion. Because the Circumlocution Office was down upon any ill-advised public servant who was going to do it, or who appeared to be by any surprising accident in remote danger of doing it, with a minute, and a memorandum, and a letter of instructions that extinguished him. It was this spirit of national efficiency in the Circumlocution Office that had gradually led to its having something to do with everything. Mechanicians, natural philosophers, soldiers, sailors, petitioners, memorialists, people with grievances, people who wanted to prevent grievances, people who wanted to redress grievances, jobbing people, jobbed people, people who couldn't get rewarded for merit, and people who couldn't get punished for demerit, were all indiscriminately tucked up under the foolscap paper of the Circumlocution Office. Numbers of people were lost in the Circumlocution Office. unfortunates with wrongs, or with projects for the general welfare, and they had better have had wrongs at first, than have taken that bitter English recipe for certainly getting them, who in slow lapse of time and agony had passed safely through other public departments, who, according to rule, had been bullied in this, overreached by that, and evaded by the other, got referred at last to the circumlocution office, and never reappeared in the light of day. Board sat upon them, secretaries minute upon them, commissioners gabbled about them, clerks registered, entered, checked, and ticked them off, and they melted away. In short, all the business of the country went through the circumlocution office, except the business that never came out of it, and its name was Legion. Sometimes, angry spirits attacked the circumlocution office. Sometimes, parliamentary questions were asked about it, and even parliamentary motions made or threatened about it by demagogues so low and ignorant as to hold that the real recipe of government was how to do it. Then would the noble lord, or right honorable gentleman, in whose department it was to defend the circumlocution office, put an orange in his pocket, and make a regular field day of the occasion. Then would he come down to that house with a slap upon the table, and meet the honorable gentleman foot to foot. Then would he be there to tell that honorable gentleman that the circumlocution office not only was blameless in this matter, but was commendable in this matter, was extollable to the skies in this matter. Then would he be there to tell that honorable gentleman that, although the circumlocution office was invariably right and wholly right, it never was so right as in this matter. Then would he be there to tell that honorable gentleman that it would have been more to his honor, more to his credit, more to his good taste, more to his good sense, more to half the dictionary of commonplaces, if he had left the circumlocution office alone, and never approached this matter. Then would he keep one eye upon the coach, or crammer from the circumlocution office sitting below the bar, and smash the honorable gentleman with the circumlocution office account of this matter. And although one of two things always happened, namely, either that the circumlocution office had nothing to say and said it, or that it had something to say of which the noble lord, or right honorable gentleman, blundered one half, and forgot the other, the circumlocution office was always voted immaculate by an accommodating majority. Such a nursery of statesmen had the department become in virtue of a long career of this nature, that several solemn lords had attained the reputation of being quite unearthly prodigies of business, solely from having practiced how not to do it, as the head of the circumlocution office. As to the minor priests and acolytes of that temple, the result of all this was that they stood divided into two classes, and, down to the junior messenger, either believed in the circumlocution office as a heaven-born institution that had an absolute right to do whatever it liked, or took refuge in total infidelity, and considered it a flagrant nuisance. The Barnacle family had for some time helped to administer the circumlocution office. The tight Barnacle branch, indeed, considered themselves in a general way as having vested rights in that direction, and took it ill if any other family had much to say to it. The Barnacles were a very high family, and a very large family. They were dispersed all over the public offices, and held all sorts of public places. Either the nation was under a load of obligation to the Barnacles, or the Barnacles were under a load of obligation to the nation. It was not quite unanimously settled which, the Barnacles having their opinion, the nation theirs. The Mr. Tite Barnacle who at the period now in question usually coached, or crammed the statesman at the head of the circumlocution office, when that noble or right honorable individual sat a little uneasily in his saddle by reason of some vagabond making a tilt at him in a newspaper, was more flush of blood than money. As a Barnacle he had his place, which was a snug thing enough, and as a Barnacle he had of course put in his son Barnacle Jr. in the office. But he had intermarried with a branch of the Stiltstockings, who were also better endowed in a sanguineous point of view than with real or personal property, and of this marriage there had been issue, Barnacle Jr. and three young ladies. What with the patrician requirements of Barnacle Jr., the three young ladies, Mrs. Tite Barnacle niece Stiltstocking, and himself, Mr. Tite Barnacle found the intervals between quarter day and quarter day rather longer than he could have desired, a circumstance which he always attributed to the country's parsimony. For Mr. Tite Barnacle, Mr. Arthur Clennam made his fifth inquiry one day at the Circumlocution Office, having on previous occasions awaited that gentleman successively in a hall, a glass case, a waiting room, and a fireproof passage, where the department seemed to keep its wind. On this occasion Mr. Barnacle was not engaged, as he had been before, with the noble prodigy at the head of the department, but was absent. Barnacle Jr., however, was announced as a lesser star, yet visible above the office horizon. With Barnacle Jr., he signified his desire to confer, and found that young gentleman singeing the calves of his legs at the parental fire, and supporting his spine against the mantel shelf. It was a comfortable room, handsomely furnished in the higher official manner, and presenting stately suggestions of the absent Barnacle, in the thick carpet, the leather-covered desk to sit at, the leather-covered desk to stand at, the formidable easy chair and hearth rug, the interposed screen, the torn-up papers, the dispatch boxes with little labels sticking out of them, like medicine bottles or dead game, the pervading smell of leather and mahogany, and a general bamboozling air of how not to do it. The present Barnacle, holding Mr. Clennam's card in his hand, had a youthful aspect, and the fluffiest little whisker, perhaps, that ever was seen. Such a downy tip was on his callow chin, that he seemed half-fledged like a young bird, and a compassionate observer might have urged that, if he had not cinched the calves of his legs, he would have died of cold. He had a superior eyeglass dangling round his neck, but unfortunately had such flat orbits to his eyes and such limp little eyelids, that it wouldn't stick in when he put it up, but kept tumbling out against his waistcoat buttons with a click that discomposed him very much. "Oh, I say, look here. My father's not in the way, and won't be in the way today," apostrophe said Barnacle Jr. "Is this anything that I can do?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, click.
Eyeglass down. Barnacle Jr. quite frightened and feeling all round himself, but not able to find it.
"You are very good," apostrophe said Arthur Clennam. "I wish, however, to see Mr. Barnacle." Apostrophe, but I say. "Look here. You haven't got any appointment, you know," apostrophe said Barnacle Jr.
By this time he had found the eyeglass, and put it up again.
"No," apostrophe said Arthur Clennam. "That is what I wish to have. Apostrophe, but I say. Look here. Is this public business?" Apostrophe asked Barnacle Jr.
Click. Eyeglass down again. Barnacle Jr. in that state of search after it that Mr. Clennam felt it useless to reply at present.
"Is it?" apostrophe said Barnacle Jr., taking heed of his visitor's brown face, "anything about tonnage or that sort of thing?" Apostrophe, apostrophe,
pausing for a reply, he opened his right eye with his hand, and stuck his glass in that inflammatory manner, that his eye began watering dreadfully.
"No," apostrophe said Arthur, "it is nothing about tonnage." Apostrophe, "then look here. Is it private business?" Apostrophe, "I really am not sure. It relates to a Mr. Dorrit." Apostrophe, "look here, I tell you what. You had better call at our house, if you are going that way. 24, Mew Street, Grosvenor Square. My father's got a slight touch of the gout, and is kept at home by it."
Apostrophe, the misguided young Barnacle evidently going blind on his eyeglass side, but ashamed to make any further alteration in his painful arrangements.
"Thank you. I will call there now. Good morning." Apostrophe, young Barnacle seemed discomfited at this, as not having at all expected him to go. "You are quite sure," apostrophe said Barnacle Jr.,
calling after him when he got to the door, unwilling wholly to relinquish the bright business idea he had conceived. That it's nothing about tonnage? Quite sure. With such assurance, and rather wondering what might have taken place, if it had been anything about tonnage, Mr. Clennam withdrew to pursue his inquiries. Mew Street, Grosvenor Square, was not absolutely Grosvenor Square itself, but it was very near it. It was a hideous little street of dead wall, stables, and dunghills, with lofts over coach houses inhabited by coachmen's families, who had a passion for drying clothes and decorating their windowsills with miniature turnpike gates. The principal chimney sweep of that fashionable quarter lived at the blind end of Mew Street, and the same corner contained an establishment much frequented about early morning and twilight for the purchase of wine bottles and kitchen stuff. Punch's shows used to lean against the dead wall in Mew Street, while their proprietors were dining elsewhere, and the dogs of the neighborhood made appointments to meet in the same locality. Yet there were two or three small airless houses at the entrance end of Mew Street, which went at enormous rents on account of their being abject hangers-on to a fashionable situation. And whenever one of these fearful little coops was to be let, which seldom happened, for they were in great request, the house agent advertised it as a gentlemanly residence in the most aristocratic part of town, inhabited solely by the elite of the beau monde. If a gentlemanly residence coming strictly within this narrow margin had not been essential to the blood of the Barnacles, this particular branch would have had a pretty wide selection among, let us say, 10,000 houses, offering 50 times the accommodation for a third of the money. As it was, Mr. Barnacle, finding his gentlemanly residence extremely inconvenient and extremely dear, always laid it, as a public servant, at the door of the country, and adduced it as another instance of the country's parsimony. Arthur Clennam came to a squeezed house, with a ramshackle bowed front, little dingy windows, and a little dark area like a damp waistcoat pocket, which he found to be number 24, Mew Street, Grosvenor Square. To the sense of smell, the house was like a sort of bottle filled with a strong distillation of mews, and when the footman opened the door, he seemed to take the stopper out. The footman was to the Grosvenor Square footman, what the house was to the Grosvenor Square houses. Admirable in his way was a back and a byway. His gorgeousness was not unmixed with dirt, and both in complexion and consistency he had suffered from the closeness of his pantry. A sallow flabbiness was upon him when he took the stopper out and presented the bottle to Mr. Clennam's nose. Be so good as to give that card to Mr. Tite Barnacle, and to say that I have just now seen the younger Mr. Barnacle, who recommended me to call here. The footman, who had as many large buttons with the Barnacle crest upon them on the flaps of his pockets, as if he were the family. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.